Hi, hello. We have a mailbag episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. We bounced all around the board. What should the Minnesota Lynx do with the number two pick? How sustainable is the New Orleans Pelicans offense? What should rec league offenses do against 2-3 zones? We bounced around. We had a lot of fun. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for embracing your bounce. Let's have some fun.
Let's have some fun indeed. Hope everyone is enjoying the holiday season. And for this episode, we are once again going to the Dunker Spot mailbag. So as always, thank you to those who send in questions. And you don't need a prompt. Whenever you're watching a game, you're bored at work, whatever the case may be, if you've got basketball questions for us, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com and we will get to them. We got a fun collection of questions for this mailbag that I'm excited to dig in on. But first, we start with the W side. This one coming from Jamae, who says, hi, Dunker Spot. The Minnesota Lynx have the number two pick in the WNBA draft. If you were the GM, what would you look to do with that pick? If selecting, who would you pick? And if you're trading the pick, who or what are you going after?
I can tell you with 100% certainty, I'm not trading that pick.
Okay.
Why would I trade that pick? I'm not supposed to be here, and I'm here, and I'm going to get a great talent at number two. So I'm going to smile, I'm going to laugh, I'm going to high five, and I call my pick in.
Okay.
If the home run prospect falls to me, fantastic. Or you get AZ Fun, or you get Olivia Miles, or hey, I trust Cheryl Reed and Lauren Betts. Can't go wrong, in my opinion. But I don't think with this certain uncertainty that's going around that you trade that pick, because who are you trading it to and for what?
Yeah, like I think the weirdness of this year where most of the league non-rookie scale division is a free agent whenever we get a new CBA ratified, and we hope we get some positive progress on that front, it kind of limits the trade options because you just don't know who's actually available to be traded for. And so for me, like I'm with you, Steve, I would likely keep the pick if I had it. If I'm going to think about trading it, it is worth noting, at least as of recording, the Washington Mystics have the fourth pick, the ninth pick, and the 11th pick in the first round. And so, like, I would consider maybe a trade back to four. If I could trade two for, like, 4 and 9, then that's something that I at least think about, or, like, 4+ future picks, because I would still be in range for, like, a Lauren Betts at 4, at least ideally. And if Lauren Betts goes earlier than that, then I'm getting one of AZ or Olivia Miles or Al Fam, and I just feel really good about that. So, like, outside of a Washington package in particular, I'm probably just staying put as well. And at that point, the guard options are interesting to me. Because, like, obviously this depends on what Dallas does. If they go Al Fam, if they want to go Lauren Betts, I don't think they go guard. So I think one of the bigs go one, if I had to guess. If you're telling me, like, I have AZ Foot that can knock down threes for me right now and or be, like, the eventual Kayla McBride replacement, I'm cool with that. And if you have any kind of concerns about Courtney Williams, point guard specifically, if you're telling me I can just lock myself into Olivia Miles moving forward, like I'm fine with that too. So guard room is probably where I go unless I'm trading back with Washington. I don't think you like try to land a superstar because I don't think you literally can with the way that things are structured contract-wise across the league. So that's where I am at. Also, just quick shout out to the Pull Up 3 podcast, Jamae, Paragon Don, Jay Trent, a fellow dunker. I'll do a great job covering women's sports there. They've had some friends of the program as guests as well. So I wanted to make sure I give the salute before we move to the next question. And thank you for that one on the Minnesota Lynx. Getting into the second one, or second group of questions, rather. This one coming from JR, who says, hello, gentlemen. Number one, is someone going to trade for Marina Mabry? I want a contender to trade for her, please. Marina's also going to be a free agent. So in a literal sense, the answer is no, I would imagine. Unless we get like some core designation stuff happening there. I do think to like a broader scope of where could Marina Mabry go if she does not return to Connecticut, which I wouldn't rule that out based on how the season went for her on and off the floor. I kind of start with Seattle Like Marina didn't shoot to her usual level because of the defensive attention that she saw last year as like the de facto number one option in Connecticut. But she can shoot the leather off the ball. And for a Seattle team that doesn't take a lot of threes, does not make a lot of threes, depending on what their roster is going to look like, that was the first like contender or pseudo contender I thought about as a Marina fit if they bring back most of their core. Like I think add her to that room, she could feel a very obvious need there in a more win now situation. And that's kind of what she's been seeking out since the Chicago trade. So that's where I would go at the very least. Do you have Marina Mabry landing spot thoughts?
Well, I mean, considering the fact that you have yelled at every Marina Mabry trade that's ever taken place on this earth, I sure am glad that she's a free agent. Now, it's interesting. She did kind of mention, I'll be back with Connecticut in September. So I do remember that. But Seattle's fine. I mean, she plays Skylar during Unrivaled. We'll see what that looks like. I'm assuming, I mean, it's hard to say because I don't know who's going to be where.
This is very true. This is very true.
I'm like, who am I projecting her to go to?
Yeah, we still don't have the expansion protection rules yet. Like we have educated guesses. We don't have anything firm yet. Again, please ratify CPA. I want to see the W next year. But okay, that is question one. Number two, who is your, this is a pure entertainment team, complimentary, squad for Unrivaled this year? Steve, who are you excited to see, independent of how good or bad they may actually be?
It's the Breeze for me. CPR, let's go. And then the Phantom. Like, you got Kelsey Plum, you got Kiki, you got Leah Boston, you got Cloud, you got Satu, you got Dana Evans. That's going to be entertaining on and off court. I think the Vinyl has some trash talk. And Lunar Owls, they have some characters, put it that way.
Okay, I like it. I like it. You are all over my notes. Breeze BC is exactly where I went first. Like, that is just a lot of youth. Also, shout out, workout video with Paige and Dominique Malanga, and Paige just throwing easy lobs to Dom, and was like, oh, that's kind of spooky. I hope we get a dunk in Unrivaled, or a few. We'll see what happens on that front. But a lot of youth, a lot of fun personalities on that group. I also had the Phantom in my notes here. It's the team that should just be a joy to both watch, but also they have a lot of characters. Get well soon, Satu, who I think is not going to be participating as she's still recovering from the concussion suffered during the finals. So hopefully she's just okay, first and foremost. But even then, like, there's a lot of funny players on that roster. And the play style should be, they're going to be dogs. They're going to live in the paint. They're going to be annoying to whoever they face. So I like that answer as well. The next one going to come from Riyadh, who says, what's up, Dunker Spot crew? In my estimation, at least four of the top five players in the W for a while now have played the power forward position. That's Asia Wilson, Nafisa Collier, Breonna Stewart, and Alyssa Thomas for clarification. We always hear about point guard being the deepest spot in the NBA, but in your opinion, which position has been the most top heavy at a given time? Feel free to pull from either the W or the NBA. Always happy to hoop it up with y'all.
I have a soft spot for power forwards during like the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. Guard play during the 80s. Bigs pre-1975. Mm-hmm. It's probably where I go. What say you?
Okay. Thanks for me. Like, I was kind of torn thinking about all these different position groups across both leagues. Like, I agree. Power forward is certainly, like, that is the top heavy group in the W right now. On the NBA side, it's kind of interesting because I was trying to figure out where do I want the cutoffs to be. I think with center in the NBA, like, right now, you have Jokic, you have Wimby, you have Şengün, but, like, Şengün's probably, like, a half tier below Wimby or a tier below Wimby, and like who's all in the Şengün tier at that point, and like how am I kind of splitting that up? And then I was in a headlock thinking about small forwards and power forwards because I don't know who plays the three and who plays the four or how you would designate that at this point. Like LeBron's more four now, Jalen Williams probably more four than three, but then OKC starting double big, so it kind of moves them to the three, so that part gets interesting. Like there's the Jason Tatum of it all, who's probably a natural three, but he plays more four since he's been in Boston. And so like I kind of landed on... I kind of landed on small forward kind of by default, just because it feels like so much of the high-end talent there is kind of sparse, kind of split between the three and the four. So depending on how you split that, it gets top-heavy pretty quickly, but it is still a deep class. So I'd say most top-heavy is probably small forward. Shooting guard is probably right behind that in the NBA. On the W side, that's probably... I was between the guard spots on the W. I think the baseline level of play for either of those positions is so high, especially the point guard spot in the W at this point.
Interesting.
got some disagreement there. What would you say is the most top heavy position? I guess mention power forward, but I guess aside from that, where would you go?
I wouldn't go point guard.
Okay.
Probably go power forward still.
Okay.
Maybe the twos.
The twos are fair. Especially if you're getting into like some of the combo guard conversation and stuff like that, who's playing both. I don't mind that. But all right, we move to Dennis, who says, "Hi, Nikias and Steve. Hope you are both doing well. Thank you so much for the continuously great analysis, expressions of enjoyment of the game, and the community you have fostered. I have deeply appreciated the playback watch parties, RIP, being able to enjoy the game amongst amazing people while learning and understanding the range of nuances that make the game the way it is has been a lovely experience, and I know the end of the playback won't stop that. My question stems from watching the NBA Cup quarterfinal between the Spurs and the Lakers. Early in that game, the Lakers seemed to be having fun with the Spurs playing drop coverage with Luke Kornet, and Stan Van Gundy's analysis that the Spurs should look to bring Kornet up to the level or switch made a lot of sense, especially against the great pick-and-roll operators that the Lakers had. Despite that adjustment being understandable if made, the Spurs stuck to their defensive philosophy and won the game. This brings me to my question. For teams and coaches, how much has to happen offensively and or defensively for adjustments to be made, especially early in a game? And how does the thinking change depending on the different contexts, i.e. the team that we're playing, the players that we're facing, it being a regular season game versus a postseason game, et cetera?"
Well, this is a fun one, so let's talk through it. Defensively, there are a lot of fun things to talk through, right? The nuances of coverages, but let's be honest, there's not an unlimited amount of schemes. You are eventually spinning the wheel to a degree. Because of that, because of your choice on how you want to defend something or your opponent, as a defense, you are always picking a poison. So I start here because that's the most important thing. What is the thing that we can live with as a defense? What can we potentially control? If this is what we give up, this is what we give up, and we deal with that until we can't. This is what we're doing on defensively. Everyone's on the same page. I think the tough part about making an adjustment very quick or early in the game is you might take away the one thing that is hurting you. So let's say it's Luka and drop or whatever the coverage is. You may now be opening up other things that hurt you. And so you have to think about not just the player that you're facing, but also the team. What do they do well? Or what box are we trying to put everyone in? If we have to live with a superstar or great player making plays, but that takes away a lot of what a team does overall, okay, instead of dealing with a wave of offense, this is this specific thing. We can navigate that 48 minutes. I mean, let's pick a big, like, let's just say like Cat, right? Let's say you start a game and you say, okay, we're going to switch at the five, Cat. We're going to switch. We're going to stay at home. We're going to show early help. We know where the rotations are. We're going to contain contests. We're going to try and bog them down. Fantastic. Got our game plan locked in. We're good. Teams have counters for switching. So let's say it doesn't go well. Gets beat off for one drive, over help, kick. Now they're going stat pick and roll, or we're slipping, or bringing someone else in the action. So that's a matchup you don't like. All right, we don't want to switch anymore. You make that decision early, right?
Yeah.
Now let's say, Kat, you're near the level of that screen. You're next to the screen there. You're going to be up, try and take away the corner from the ball handler. Now guess what opens up? The roll or the pop. And now you're in rotation. And if you've gotten dinged on both of those things early in the game, now you're trying to figure out which one are we taking away? You didn't pick a poison. Everything's on the table. And now you have an offensive team and a rhythm, and that's what you want to avoid. So it's a delicate balance, right? So if we bring it back to the example at hand, bringing it back to Luka, right? What type of shots is he making against our drop right now? What type of passes are available or are being made? If this is a scenario, we are active on ball, we're navigating, we're able to recover, we're close, and he's just hitting fadeaways or floaters. Okay, if that's the shot we gave up, probably want to lock in on that, make it a little bit tougher, but we can live with that. If it's pure pull-ups, okay, we might figure that out. We might have Luke Kornet just kind of get closer to the elbow and say, okay, let's take away that specific spot on the court. That's going to be a late switch. Let's just try and throw something off. Let's stick with our thought process. As a coach, you're thinking, okay, is this just one player that's hurting us? Is this working against everyone else? So if it's Luka that's dinging us and gets 10, 12 and a quarter, which he does all the time in the first quarter, but Austin Reeves isn't having a great time, that's not the end of the world for us, is it? If DeAndre Ayton isn't really getting loose on the short roll or making us pay or making us rotate when he does catch, this isn't the end of the world. If we're out of rotation, we're taking away skip passes for threes or drives once the ball is sprayed out, are we in a good spot overall? Yeah. Luka's just kind of cooking. Mm-hmm. Not great. Need to make it harder on him, but
yeah.
Great player, does great things. Overall, I feel good about our defense. Gets trickier in the fourth quarter. A lot of these defenses you live with until you can't. And we rarely talk about how the shot you're willing to give up hurts, and now you have to consider what to do in a big moment. Drop coverage, you know exactly what shots are open. Not fun to deal with in a fourth quarter. You know exactly what players can do when they want to attack one-on-one in fourth quarters. Not ideal. And so the overall point back to the question is, offensively, I have to do enough things well to get you to blink. And if I do that, that's a win for me. I can now put the rest of what I want to do offensively on the table on top of having success with whatever you were trying to take away. Defensively, I'm still always trying to take something away, get you into a box and force you to operate there. Trying to take something where I know I'm taking something away and this is a shot you have. It's a back and forth all the time. And so that's where it's like, how much has to happen offensively? A whole lot of shot making, or you got to feel like it's not sustainable. And even that counter, right? It might not be changing the scheme. It might be a lineup change, guys. It might be a couple possessions of zone. It might be that late switch. It might be getting closer to the level of that screen and dropping back and saying, okay, well, let's just give you a different look for 2 seconds. But even then, it's today's NBA, man.
It's tough.
Offenses still present a different problem. The Knicks played the Heat. Jalen Brunson scored, 47 points. Losing his mind within the flow of the Knicks offense. Attacking, moving defense. It's fourth quarter. Hey, Norm Powell, come here. Mm-hmm. It's not a big. Okay, so we got to switch. What do we want to do with that? We want to switch and double? Okay. let's get you in rotation and get a shot we want. Okay, we can't do that. Let's switch and show help. Okay, let's get me off the ball real quick and then we'll swing and find a three. You're always kind of measuring and trying to poke at something, but offenses are always working to just try and expose you once you make that decision.
I like that. Good stuff from Steve. I think this is one of my, I love the question, but two, this is also like one of my favorite questions to ask coaches. And like, it's something I've gotten to ask Becky Hammon about, Noel Quinn about, a few other W coaches, like aside from the actual adjustment itself, whether that is to your point, Steve, okay, we're going to go zone for a few possessions, or we're going to flip who we have guarding said star. We're going to flip if we weren't doubling early in the game, we're now going to double. If we were doubling, we're not going to do it anymore. Where we're sending the double teams, et cetera. It's like, how do you balance want to establish that base and living with something versus this is not working? We have to do something differently. And it either works or it doesn't. But I just love trying to get into that dichotomy. And like talking to Becky in particular, like she has always said at the very least, like, no, I don't mind scrapping things early. And there have been a few games where we are playing against a star guard. We're going to try to put two on the ball. Let's try to be disruptive. Plays are made. Okay, let's not do that anymore. Let's just force these pick and rolls down the sideline, or let's switch a little bit more. But it's like within the first quarter, we have come out with this. It did not work. Let's get back to this, and we're just going to live from here. Like we saw that in a few of the Fever games last season in particular, for an example. And so like, I feel like the boring answer is that it varies by coach. As Steve has actual coaching experience, he naturally has a better feel and answer for this than I do. But like I, ideally, at the very least, as a non-coach, and I would like to say, like, I would want to give this a quarter with whatever it is, unless it turns into like a foul trouble bit, depending on like a specific matchup or something like that. But if not, give it a quarter and then let's see where we can kind of adjust to from there. I want to give it a little bit of breathing room. Because to your point, like, I don't want to feel like we flip too early, now they're dinging something else, and now everyone's comfortable. And like, I can't put all this back in a box.
No, I mean, I think the one thing I will say and add to it is lineup versatility and scheme versatility becomes very important and is going to allow you to try and do different things in different ways at different times without necessarily giving away the whole bank, right? So look, you need your big to be able to execute, at the very least, execute multiple schemes. So at least you have that in your back pocket that, okay, we can be at the level, we can trap, we can put two on the ball, we can switch, we can do a late switch. Whatever it is, okay, we have that in our back pocket. You work through those throughout the season so you can pivot when you need to, especially when it comes postseason time. The other thing is key is that really when you have these top players, the biggest thing you want to do is be able to throw different things at them. And so that's where you need to be able to have an understanding of what your coverages are so you can throw different things at them to keep them off balance, keep them off rhythm. So that's probably more of a playoff context, but we see it in the regular season where it's like, okay, Anthony Edwards, we're going to show you about two or three different coverages. Devin Booker, we're going to show you two or three different coverages just to make you think and to get you out of being automatic. And so that can be cat and mouse depending on what the coach wants to do. The interesting part is like the lineup versatility. I think it kind of allows you to do a different scheme without changing what your main thing is overall. You know, we can go smaller and we can say, okay, we're switching with this particular lineup, or we're switching 1 through 4, or, you know, we have a smaller 5 that we switch, or you see teams put a wing on a big or put a big on a non-shooter. So we can keep our base of what we want to do and change who's involved in the action. So like with Denver, okay, Jokic guards a non-shooter. The offense is going to respond by making that person a screener, but now the threat's not the same. So yeah. is that the same level of roller? Not really. So can we get in and get out quicker? Are we now able to do what we want to do defensively? I think Phoenix and Golden State the other night went back and forth. Mark Williams, you're on Jimmy Butler. And then Jimmy Butler became a screener. Nah. And then Jimmy Butler became a shooter. And then Stephen Curry started setting back picks for Jimmy Butler. So it goes hand in hand. It goes back and forth.
There we go. Good stuff there from Steve. And our next question is going to
I wasn't done answering his question because he had multiple questions.
Oh, my bad. Go ahead.
You asked the question. How'd you forget?
I did think I forgot.
So I'd say when it comes to like the game plan portion, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's a balance between how much do we lock in on what we do and how much do we focus on what they do. Mm-hmm. And are we bringing our base to the table and adjusting based on what we see, or are we trying to take away a specific thing? And so great players are going to take great coverages, so you're going to have to throw something at them. Or it might be personnel. Like, we want this person to guard him then, or this person to guard him then. Postseason's all different animal, though. We know this team inside and out. We know exactly what we want to take away. It's going to be on them to beat us. That's where it becomes more fascinating to see which team blinks first in a playoff series, because this whole thing is built for this specific reason. If you play well enough to make me go, oh, I need to do this, that's why you see a team struggle in one series, look great the next, or you see a team figure one thing out. It's all about problem solving. What's the issue? We figure it out. Now we're back to being us. Off to the races. Okay, I'm done.
Oh, there we go. Like, last thing I'll say on that front, like, as you got to that last point, it reminded me of the W Finals, where if you get to game one, the Aces eke it out, but they had to go zone. And one of the first things Nate Tibbett says is, I kind of like that they had to go zone this early. It makes me feel better about what our offense is if they feel like they had to blink first in that regard. Ultimately, did not end up mattering, but it kind of goes to your point that, hey, we have this plan going in. We want to stick with this as long as we possibly can. And the other team is trying to poke at things and make you change direction there. So good stuff there. Our next question is going to come from Eli, who says, it seems that every night there's at least one game where a large lead gets cut down significantly. 20-point leads are as precarious as 5-point leads. I'm a bit of an NBA noob, so I don't know if this was as common of an occurrence in previous seasons. But if this is a new development, did last season's playoffs start it? Is there a specific reason for the trend, like a league-wide shift in mindset and or play style? Is it a result of more teams trying to be like the Pacers, or is it less blanket and more individual team-specific reasons that have nothing to do with each other? Love y'all's work.
I mean, I think style of play dictates a lot, and a lot of teams playing faster can open the door for different things. But I also think a lot of teams are just better offensively. Like, even the quote-unquote bad basketball teams are better than teams 10 years ago offensively, as far as being willing to let it fly, as far as being willing to play quick. You can watch the Wizards right now. They can generate good looks. They can get to ball movement. Now, can they always get you in rotation? No. Can they sustain it? Not particularly, but they know how to get there when they have to. So a lot of teams are using pace and tempo and shooting to build a lead. The other team most times is doing the same thing to try and maintain. If you're the winning team and one of those positive things slows down, either your pace goes down, your tempo goes down, or you're not making shots, and the other team is still doing the same thing, you put yourself in a position where 17 can become 12, 12 can become 5, and now you're in a dogfight very quickly. Defenses can let their foot off the gas. Offenses miss shots. You get too methodical, or you get too one-shot option, or you try and slow it down too much. Just like that, 6-8 points. You turn it over, you get a miss, 3-3. Before you blink, you're in a different game. And so I just think it's overall the whole league playing a different style and a willingness to shoot threes, and both sides playing well. Like, I think Miami has gotten themselves in trouble to a degree during this stretch because their offense is based on playing quick, getting it up quick, getting into different things. Okay, you start making shots. You're playing Orlando's and New York's and Boston, who, oh, we do that too.
We want to run a little bit more.
Okay, now we've answered with some quick buckets. Now what are you going to do? So I think that's where it gets interesting.
I guess that's kind of what I wanted to ask you about, like, as someone that's been in these rooms, like, how do you kind of balance maintaining your style or your pace of play when you have that kind of lead? Like, how difficult isn't the word I'm thinking of, but it does feel like there are a lot of complaints league-wide about my favorite team has a big lead. They are now playing prevent offense, and now here comes this deficit getting chopped down. Like, is it hard to kind of tell players when they have these leads, like, no, do not stop, do not take your foot off the gas? It's a very human thing on top of that. But, like, how do you kind of work through that?
Well, I mean, it's just a game of basketball, because you can say don't take your foot off the gas, but you play too quick, you hit yourself in the foot either way. Mm. You know what I mean? Okay, let's keep going. Let's go fast. Okay, we've taken a bunch of quick shots. We haven't executed anything, and they're back in the game. So it's just about finding the balance. That's why identity is so important offensively and understanding who you are. Take a look at Houston. Everyone wants to yell at Houston for who they lost to. Pay attention to what's happening in these games. Houston is already a slow team. They become even slower in these moments where they're trying to make sure they get a good shot. The problem with that is that limits you to one option or bust. And so you would like to avoid those unless you got someone cooking. You know, if you have the Anthony Edwards, the Cades, the Jalen Brunsons, we've seen great players be able to get whatever shot they want. And really, sometimes these scenarios only need is one or two to fall to get momentum back. And then you get back to what you do. But I think it just ties into who are we. If we're a naturally slower team, okay, we just need to execute our offense. We need to actually run something to get something moving. If we're a team that is relying on being quick, okay, who has the ball? Where are they at? Are we flowing? Are we keeping pressure on the defense? Are we taking the first possible shot because we feel like we need to get one up? That's kind of the balancing act. So it depends on who you are as a team.
Okay, understood. I think you pretty much nailed all the major notes there. I was going to base this around just the rise of the three-point shot in general and the kind of variance that opens up. In basketball games like this, you get on a hot streak or a cold streak, as you mentioned already, it's a lot easier for those loose to either balloon or get cut short. And so don't want to hang there too long.
Did you have numbers?
No, not for this one. I was looking because I know there have been a whole lot of stuff that are flashed through, like broadcasts and stuff. I was like, is there a site that I can like actually track what this is looking like? I have the overall like three-point rates and stuff, like how that's risen. But in terms of deficits, how quickly they get cut down, or like how many 20-point leads are safe like that, I had trouble finding that to have that specifically for this one. But I think the three ball is going to be, or it has been, a pretty big reason to why these kind of comebacks and things exist. And we hope you come back after we take this quick break. We have a few more questions to dig into. Stay tuned.
The smartest NBA coverage is live on YouTube 5 days a week. Watch the Dunker Spot featuring Nekias Duncan and myself, delivering elite X's and O's, some of the best film breakdowns you could find in the universe. Kevin O'Connor, deep analysis, sharp hoops conversations. And every week, Tom Haberstroh and Dan Devine will break down the stats to define the league on the big number. Plus, fast daily NBA updates and trends from Dan Titus to keep you ahead of the timeline. If you love basketball, welcome home.
And we are back with this mailbag episode of the Dunker Spot. Our next question going to come from Miles, who says, when everyone minus Fred VanVleet is healthy, who are the five guys you'd want on the floor for the Houston Rockets to close a tight playoff game?
You have two options you need to work through. One that I think you need to start just throwing it out there and seeing what the good and the bad is, and the other that in a playoff setting you may want to go to because of defense. It's Reed Sheppard, Amen, KD, Jabari Smith, and Alperen Şengün. I think you need to work towards understanding what that is and what it isn't. I think in a playoff series, I would probably put Tari Eason, Amen Thompson, Kevin Durant, Jabari, and Şengün. But I would ask Tari Eason very politely to not overhelp off the corner when we are winning by 2 points.
Yeah, like... Actually, I'll ask you right there, because like that play was also top of mind for me. Did you feel like that was an overhelp? Did you feel like, oh, he thinks the shot is going up? Let me see if I can get hands on someone type B. Like, what did you think his read was? It was incorrect because it gave up the three. But like, what do you think he was thinking in that moment?
Yes, I think it was an overhelp. I'm fairly certain he either thought there's going to be a commitment from the block or that DeMar was going to shoot it. And so he magnet pulled towards the rim and it's like, no. You're winning. You just stay out there. And with tough twos are okay. Tough twos are okay. Tough twos are okay.
I know that one in particular had to get you, but it's like, yeah, Tari, that is like literally the one shot that we cannot give up in this situation. But for me, it is Reed, Amen, Jabari, KD, and Shingun. And like, I think the Tari Eason one is a good lineup to have. I am a big fan of just having collective size across the board. But Reed is such a dynamic pull-up shooter. And I just think you need that element for this Houston offense. And I think this regular season, within reason, a good bit of it should be dedicated towards, okay, what are the defensive answers that we feel comfortable getting to with Reed Shepherd? Now, how clean can we get these pre-switches to go? If we are going to go switch and double, we saw that a lot in the second matchup between Houston and Denver over the weekend, or last weekend rather at this point. Okay, can we be cleaner on those? We saw Amen Thompson get burned on one. We also saw Amen Thompson blindside someone for a steal. It's like, okay, can we find more consistency if we're going to go switch and double? Do we want to go zone at any point with Reed Shepherd in the game? I think if you can find enough defensive answers, like the shooting, the pull-ups, the drives that he can sprinkle in, the playmaking that he can sprinkle in, what he can unlock and pick and roll for you, I just think you need that on the floor with who they have. I think Kevin Durant, great. Tough shot maker. Alperen Sengun, especially with those, I'm going to pivot, sprinkle in these push shots. Great, tough shot makers. I would like somebody that kind of grease the wheels for one of those two or get a bucket for themselves. And I think Reed represents the best case, with, especially with Fred out for the foreseeable future. I would like to see Houston figure that out with Reed right now. Can I give you some numbers, Steve?
Before you give me numbers, how do you grease the wheel for those two when they get the attention?
Okay, more so like you are going to see, like with KD, the off-ball physicality and stuff like that, the switches that KD may see, even some of the switches you may see with Alperen Sengun when those two are used in action together. Like, I think with Reed, it's a tougher deal for teams to be like, yeah, we'll switch this too, because you're generally going to have someone smaller on Reed. So if you're using him in pick and roll or you're using Reed as a screener for one of those two guys, I think that poses tougher decisions for defenses.
I mean, I think they probably just let him live, considering we're doubling Kevin Durant. We're rotating to Sengun on the short roll. And if you throw it back to KD, we're doubling again. But I understand. What are your numbers?
I was going to have on the lineup front, as of recording, with the quartet of Amen, Jabari, KD, and Sengun on the floor, it's nearly a plus five in over 400 minutes together so far. With Josh Okogie, who has been the starter, he's closed out a lot of games for Houston, especially as of late. It's a plus 31 in 214 minutes with Josh Okogie as the fifth. With Reed Shepherd as the fifth, a plus 33 in 82 minutes. Again, smaller sample, plus by the slightly higher right now. Again, I just want more of a sample with this. Like, let's get some Reed Shepherd answers. Like, he just poses, he just stands as one of the most important players that they have for their short term and long term. So, like, I would want to get answers. And if you ultimately find, okay, actually, the defense is just kind of untenable. Like, we actually just cannot do this. And he isn't making enough shots for it to be worth it. Once we get into the playoffs, all right, then cool. We can shift to Tari. We go back to Josh Okogie. If you want to go double big without Prince Shingun, Steven Adams, that runs you into like some free throw stuff, depending on when you have him in. But I would use the regular season to figure out what the Reed thing is and then pivot bigger if we have to. That's where I land. This one going to come from Jeremy, who says, the Pelicans, since November 19th, are tied for the 11th best offense in the NBA, a little over 117 offensive rating per clean in the glass. When you two watch the film, do you see any sustainability in their new offense that has the philosophy of relentlessly attacking the basket? Nearly 47% of the shots coming from 4 feet and in, and it's a 41% rim rate in the half court, while cutting down the three ball. It's about a 28% three-point rate. This question coming from December 21st for reference, so those numbers may be a little bit different by the time you hear this one. But, Steve, what is the film saying to you about the New Orleans Pelicans offense and its sustainability style-wise?
Well, we were both asked, but I think there is sustainability. I think you have a combination of elements, like playing through Derek Queen certainly helps. And his passing ability allows you to open up more movement off ball, so you can have screening actions on both sides. You can get dribble handoffs to get downhill. I think if nothing has been there for the Pelicans, instead of holding the ball and waiting for a screen, like it's not like pick and roll is gone, but we're going to drive the basketball, or we're going to get to drive and kick, or we're going to get to drive and finish. And so opening a side for Trey Murphy to attack instead of him just being off staggers or off handoff is fun. Herb Jones allow him an opportunity to get downhill and just be involved. I think that's one thing that more teams have done this season is let's take our non-shooter or non-threat and put the ball in their hands and let's see how you help or how you assist and what that opens up. And so, okay, can we test your ability to stay true to your base and can we find a way to either get a bucket for him or get a bucket for someone else? You know, Jeremiah Fears is going to get downhill relentlessly. The three-point thing, I think that comes down to the amount of shooters the Pelicans have and their ability to generate, like, what kind of shots they're generating. Because even if you go back to the Pacers game, it's an early Sadiq Bey three in transition, and then there's a Jeremiah Fears kick to Herb for a three in the corner. But I do think, especially with Zion coming off the bench, you now flow into more paint stuff. So there's just complete elements of we're going to try and make things happen in the paint. And so I do think it is sustainable. And so it's been good to see the Pelicans putting forth this kind of effort offensively.
Mm-hmm. I'm right there with you, especially the way that they have opened things up with Derek Queen. I think in general, if you have a five that can play make the way that he can and can also drive the way that he can, like you just have a way of inverting your offense. And like, I don't think teams are going to take that away, especially with the lines they can toss in. Like I have personally enjoyed the Derek Queen plus Zion minute so far. The fact that you could use either one of those guys as hubs, and if one guy doesn't have an attack or a two-man action with one of those guys doesn't work, you now swing it to the other side, and now they get to operate together. And so that combined with the overall, I guess, further emphasis of pace is the way that I would frame it, because they weren't a slow team under Willie Green. They were around top 10 in how quickly they got across half court in terms of average possession length, how quickly they got into their first action, around top 10 in those areas. They are playing noticeably faster since Willie Green has been let go. And so that plus leaning just more into the youth, Jeremiah Fears, like he hasn't been as bothered by full court pressures you would think a young guard would be. And the way he's able to shift pace in the half court as well kind of sticks out. So he should still be able to get to the rim when necessary. And because you are reintroducing like the Zion into this offense, whether he's coming off the bench or just when he's on the floor, like I don't know how comfortable teams are going to be saying, we don't really trust the shooters. Let's just switch everything and see what happens. Because they have drivers in the front court that kind of mash smaller guys, Zion in particular. Derek Queen does not mind driving against smaller players. And if you get a bigger player at space, you know, switched out onto Jeremiah Fears, like you're probably not going to stay in front of him for too long without showing extreme help. And I do think with Trey Murphy in particular, like him and Sadiq Bey, they're good shooters and they're very good at moving off the ball on top of that. And there is an emphasis of we're going to cut, we're going to relocate as well. So I don't feel like there's anything unsustainable about what they're trying to get to offensively. Like, I would like to see the three-point rate perk up. But to your point, Steve, the personnel is just kind of what it is right now. And so, like, I think I have more of kind of like a smaller view, like how many threes will Derek Queen take since he's going to be above the break with so many of these things anyway. Like, if teams give him space because they're expecting some kind of handoff, like, how many of those is he going to fire above the break? But I don't know if that's going to be enough to shift this three-point rate from, like, 28% to, like, 35% or something like that. There's probably room for more, but the pace plus emphasis of driving the basketball based on who they have, that should be consistent. So I like that one. Did you have any other Pelicans thoughts before we move?
No.
Okay. All right. Next two are going to come from Andrew, who says, obviously, Portland has been limited lately, largely due to injuries, but oftentimes I find myself watching an offense that has little flow or intentional movement, especially late in games. Having a true point guard on the court would surely help get things structured, but without one, we end up seeing a lot of Denny and Shade and ISO ball and a whole lot of stagnant guys around whichever one of them has the ball. It has me thinking a bit about how I would restructure things offensively to get more movement. Shaden excels when catching the ball on the move, and not many players are better at getting downhill than Denny. Two questions. One, how can the Blazers maximize the offense with their current personnel to execute better late game situations? And two, how would you evaluate the job Tiago Splitter has done through his first roughly 20 games as an NBA head coach? What is he doing well, and what would you like to see improve?
Well, I think one thing for Portland is it's key for them to get stops, then get out in transition, and they can flow and take some of the quicker shots they would like to, or at least get into something earlier and easier. I think with this current group, I mean, you just miss Drew Holiday a lot. And so I don't necessarily if you're watching the Blazers, if I'm an opposing defense, why would I not switch everything? And so you want to get the handoffs for either of those players. That's going to be a switch. And that kind of dings your off-ball movement a little bit because, okay, are we getting something out of this or is the defense just switching? And so I think what you have is the element in the moments where Portland gets a stop and they run, either make or miss, or they get scored on, and now it feels like it takes 10 seconds to get into something. And so I feel like there's not that much in between, right? Like, you go back to even the Sacramento game they just played. It was like, stop, run, stop, run, stop, run. And then 4 minutes into the game, they haven't really run a set because they haven't had to. But in those fourth quarters, you have to. And so you know where the ball is going to be in the fourth quarter for Portland. So for them, it's just kind of staying consistent. I think probably getting into a second action and continuing to play off of it. And so I think one of the sets I know they've run is like a pin down for Shaden Sharp. And then you use Klingon on the wing to kind of be a flare if Shaden doesn't get the ball. And so you can do stuff like that. But eventually, like, you have to win drives to get teams in rotation, and you have to make shots to make them pay. And this is a team that takes a lot of quick shots. So I don't know if you're going to always get the balance of execution, especially as teams want to switch this particular unit.
Yeah, and I think just the bounce off of that, and honestly, the kind of bounce off of the Pelicans conversation we just had, like, this Portland group just does not have a lot of shooting on the roster. So even some of the off-ball stuff they get to, even to the non-Shaden division, it's just like, why would I care about this? Even if we don't switch, we can navigate it. You're trying to get downhill in some capacity. We're just going to flood the paint. It doesn't matter. And like, even going to some of the late game stuff with Portland, they try to get into some of the mismatch hunting with Denny Avdija, or they'll do so with Shaden Sharp. We'll feed you a matchup. And from there, it's just like, well, yeah, we're just showing bodies. Like, if you would like to kick the ball out to Chris Murray, who can knock down shots, but again, he is at the level where NBA defenses are like, we have to run him off the line or else we're going to die. It's not that level yet. To Monte Kamara, who's had a hot three-point shooting stretch as of late, he's still not at the level where NBA defenses are like, oh no, we can't have this. And you get into some of the second unit guys, Caleb Love, CD Sissoko, et cetera. It's just like, well, we don't really, it's fine. I want to say if it wasn't the second, I'm trying to remember which game it was, but like, it turned into a bunch of switch and double against Denny. And it's just like, well, this is kind of unfortunate because you technically have a 4-on-3, but we're just taking away all the rim stuff. We are funneling your passes to this specific player because we're not afraid of this. And so for Tiago Splitter, like, one, I think he's done a solid job, especially within the context of all these injuries they've had to deal with. But like, there are only so many buttons to press when NBA defenses don't respect the perimeter players that you have out there. And we can just kind of flood the paint against them. And so, like, I don't know how much I ding Tiago for that. That's just more, you are going to be guarded a certain way. You just have to make enough shots to where you make them pay. It's kind of where I'm at with the Portland offense. I guess quickly to the point guard point, especially with Denny handling as much as he is, like, it is worth keeping an eye on how he deals with full court pressure and how he deals with just two on the ball in general. Like, I think he's gotten better at it, but he's not natural, like, playmaking wing. Or, yeah, playmaking wing, but he's not, like, a point guard in the wing's body. Like, there is another level for him to get to as a ball handler, which I think reinforces in late in games, okay, let's put two on Denny, or let's go switch and double against Denny. Let's see how he handles it. And also, because of who you have around him, we're okay. So I think that is where I land on that front. You mentioned the Klingon thing. Is it, this doesn't feel like a heavy, like, flat spacing group late in games. Like, if you want to alleviate some of the high help that they see on some of these drives when they go mismatch hunting, like, maybe that is something they can sprinkle in more late in games. But I do think it's largely going to be Shaden or Denny win your matchup late in games. Like, I don't think they're going to turn into a motion offense late. This next one going to come from Dez, who says, hey, Steve and Nikias, hello. I have a question about the Indiana Pacers. Coming into the season, I thought it would be interesting to watch the Pacers try and navigate a season without Tyrese Halliburton. Unfortunately, their season has been more weird than interesting. They've dealt with significant injuries, but they still haven't looked much better now that Andrew Nembhard and Benedict Mathurin are back in the rotation. Why have they continued to struggle, and do you think they can get anything out of this season?
I mean, I think it's just been an up-and-down year. I didn't get much from the bigs. The defense wasn't where it needed to be at the start. You get everyone hurt, unfortunately. You do get your defense in order, and you start winning some games, and then the cut break happens and you are down by a whole bunch of points to the Wizards and the Pelicans within a week. And so for me, it's just been an odd mix where I don't know if they've been able to trust one thing that allows them to be themselves again. We've seen pace and tempo. We've seen them move the ball. We've seen defense be at a high level. And what happens when, you know, they get stops, can run. I think offensively in the half court, you know, Moore and Teague were just like, okay, we're going to switch a whole lot of this. So the passes are there. The mindset's still there. But, okay, are you going to be able to win a matchup? And if you win a matchup, do I not have to come in and help? And can you make us pay if we come in and help? And then if you're not guarding on the other end, you put yourself in danger. Can I read you a quote, Nathias?
You sure can.
From the great and excellent Caitlin Cooper, if I can find it again. Describing the defense. Can you guess what this quote is?
Oh, boy. It's Caitlin, so it's going to be something colorful. What is it?
I'm scrolling. December 20th, the defense is basically tumbleweeds blowing across an abandoned alley.
Ooh.
Nothing I can truly add to that.
Ooh, yeah, that's that'll do. Shout out to friend of the program, Caitlin Cooper. Yeah, I think on a basic level, there just hasn't been stability on either end. Like, it's one thing to deal with injuries. It's another thing to essentially lose your entire guard room to start the year. It's just like, what exactly are we supposed to do here? Because I think if you were high on the Pacers, or, you know, relatively high on the Pacers, and that they would be able to hold water while Tyrese is out, a lot of that was going to be surrounded by Pascal Siakam playing at an all-NBA level, Andrew Nembhard and or Benedict Mathurin taking some sort of offensive leap, and the defense holding. And I think when Nembhard misses time and Mathurin misses time, and Pascal's been, you know, very good this year overall. We just talked about him a little bit during the All-Star conversation last week. But teams are like, yeah, we'll switch this stuff. And also, you are just going to see all the double teams you can handle. That puts the spotlight on the others to make plays, knock down shots. That largely hasn't happened. And I think to the defense point, one, because the offense is bad, like, they haven't been able to set their defense as much as they want. And considering that this is at the high end, one of those high backcourt pickup teams, we want to pressure you from the inbound on to see if we can force some turnovers, or at the very least to see if we can bleed some clock. If you can't establish that, that kind of dings what your foundation is. And then, you know, bouncing to what you said, Steve, they haven't gotten enough from the bigs. Like, there have been stretches I've really enjoyed from Jay Huff in particular, but like beyond him, there's been inconsistency in that center room. And so you're not really able to establish that. And that's before getting into something that we've talked about before this season, Steve, just more teams leaning into this full court pressure, and thus offenses having more reps against it, offenses having more counters against it. So like, even when they get to that bag, it doesn't feel as effective as it was last year. And so like, without that, you don't get the easy stuff on offense. And I don't think you've gotten the kind of leap that you wanted from Andrew Nembhard or Benedict Mathurin offensively. I think there have been stretches when the shot making is there for Nembhard. There have been pockets where you have the Benedict Mathurin drives, you have some of the shot making, you have the flashes of quicker decision making, which always makes my eyes light up, because my biggest thing with him has been, you can't be catch and hold guy. But like, that hasn't been consistent enough for that to work. And so you're not getting the relief for Pascal. And it just kind of snowballs together. I think to the overarching, what can you take from the season, or what can you learn? I think you can still get some answers. Like, this is technically a contract year for Benedict Mathurin. You evaluate what steps he's making on either end. Like, one of the things that intrigued me early this season was like, oh, they're giving him the Anthony Edwards matchup in that early matchup against Minnesota. Like, okay, we're going to move him around a little bit defensively and challenge him a little bit. Offensively, again, he's going to have more on his plate in terms of the on-ball reps, but what are your decisions being made? How quickly are you making those decisions? And so, like, you kind of gather answers on, has he made the steps that we need him to? Are we committing to this? Because naturally, he should just be better and have an easier context when Tyrese Haliburton comes back. So, like, you have those kind of answers with the Jay Huff swing. Like, okay, is this enough to commit to moving forward? Maybe not you are the center of the future or anything like that, but do we want you to be part of this rotation mix? And some of the younger guys that have gotten opportunities in this case, Jairus Walker, tracking him on both ends of the floor. Do we feel better about what he is, who he can guard, what his ideal offensive role is? So, like, I think there are still things to evaluate, even if the overall season is the Pacers finish 13th or 14th or something like that. So that's where we go there. The next one going to come from Blue Sky. This is from Snacks on Snacks, which, tremendous name. But we got three, Steve. One, Miami and Cleveland have the same-ish record as a recording, but Bam Adebayo gets all of the all-star nods over Evan Mobley despite similar stats. What gives? I actually want to pause there. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, no, I just wanted to get that one first before, like, reading the other two. Like, it has been interesting kind of listening to slash having the conversations around both of them. Like, with Evan Mobley in particular, which get well soon as he's dealing with the calf strain, it does feel like his season has been more defined by the leap that he hasn't taken versus what he's actually done. And, like, I think he's been good this year. Like, the issue within the context of the Cavs is, like, they needed him to be great. And so, like, his good feels underwhelming because of that more than, like, Mobley's been bad. That's kind of the general point I wanted to make there.
Well, I mean, if you're a tiebreaker, everyone has different subjective tiebreakers. So if you feel better about the Bam season and they have the same record, why wouldn't you go Bam? You could argue Bam's had a better defensive year than Evan Mobley, and the Cavs haven't been very good. And Evan Mobley's been a portion of that. I could see how you could flip towards Bam.
Mm-hmm. Like, I would go Bam over Mobley because of the defense. But, like, I don't think it's unfair to note, like, I don't think Bam has been in a different tier than Evan Mobley this season, if we're just grading their individual years. Especially as, you know, it's funny that we get this question now, as at least as of recording, Bam was in the midst of one of the worst offensive stretches he's had this season. Which is, I think it's like 12 points, 45% on twos, has not made a three. Free throw shooting is down, at least during this current stretch of play. We'll see if that perks up moving forward. It should. But yeah, I could certainly understand why, like, a Cavs fan or just in general is just like, well, why are we talking about this guy like he's up here and this other guy when he's down here when they should probably be around the same range? Even if, again, I would say Bam has had a better season, but, like, I don't think it's been demonstrably so. So I can understand questioning, like, why that disparity kind of exists.
Got it.
But I think that's where it's at. And to Steve's point, like, the fact that Cleveland has just not lived up to expectations. And to Mobley's portion of this, I think he's been very good defensively. I don't know if he's been quite DPOY level this year. And offensively, the drives have been fine. But again, like, they haven't bent defenses. And part of that is because of the players around him and teams are saying, actually, we're just trying to take drives off the board for you and Donovan Mitchell on top of this. So, like, your context is worse. And I don't think he has thrived within that. So, again, it kind of just gives the feeling of it feels worse right now. And in some aspects, it is. This is the lowest 2-point percentage he's had in his career so far. But yeah, it's an interesting one on that front. To the second question, is there physical evidence of Jaden McDaniels navigating a screen without switching? Which,
yes.
The answer is yes. That is incredible shade towards Jaden McDaniels. I will say, to take the question more seriously, he is switching more than he did last year, and Minnesota overall is switching more than they did last season. And the question I want to pose to you, Steve, is, like, has that mattered to you at all when evaluating Minnesota's defense this year, as they had the weird start to the year? They are firmly a top 10 defense right now. Like, has the switching, like, registered for you positively or negatively?
As far as, like, blaming them for their defense struggle, or what
no, like literally anything. Like, has that been, like, a note for you? Like, this feels like a little bit more than last year. I know you had the conversation, like, their defense has to hit a certain level to get to the peak, but, like, within that, has the switching been, like, a part of that for you at all?
Not particularly.
Okay. That is fair. But yeah, switch rate up about 5 percentage points from last year, both team-wide and for Jaden McDaniels. So, like, that part is interesting. Like, I imagine a good bit of that is Jaden plus, like, some of the second unit stuff. When you get to, like, Nas plus Julius Randle in the front court, they're naturally switching more in those lineups. But it is kind of interesting to me. And for the third question, what positions do you think are generally most or least valuable to throw a second round pick for a warm body 10th man? Aaron Holiday, Landry Shamet, Zach Collins, etc.
Depends on your team. I mean, you mm-hmm. shouldn't trade a second round pick with someone you can actually play. Mm-hmm. So I don't even necessarily think it, like, I don't know if there's one specific position that works. Like, you need a shooter, you get a shooter. You need a point guard, you get a point guard. You need a big, get a big.
I feel you. Like, I think there naturally there is like the scene specific what do we need portion of this. But this question did send me down a rabbit hole, Steve.
How?
Because I was like, you know, like, who are the guys that have just been traded for seconds? Which took me to like the transaction log for like the last 3 years and seeing who's been booed for seconds. Like non-draft day trade division. End up splitting those guys or notable names at the very least into like different position groups to see like who's actually gotten, which group has gotten more, the most bang for its buck in this group. And so I will not bore you with the entire list. Just know it includes Gary Payton II and Gordon Hayward, Sadiq Bey. We had the James Wiseman trade, Mason Plumlee. There are a few other names here. And so like, judge by looking at some of these guys that have been moved for seconds, like it feels like the point guard room and the center room has probably been your best bet at actually getting a contributor. But that also had me in a bit of a loop because I'm just like, I feel like I can find a center in particular on some 10 days or just in the free agency pool in general if I need a guy that can hold down the fort defensively, set some screens, and generally stay out of the way. So, like, I don't think I want to move a second for a center if I can help it. And it's a similar bit for point guards, but like those have generally been the two position groups that have been most successful. The wing group is all over the place. I will not go on yet another Gordon Hayward rant and what the OKC experiment was. But like you see some of those swings, it just kind of brought me to with wings being such a premium in the league. If those guys are available for seconds, excluding like some extenuating circumstances, they're probably available for a reason. And so it gets hazy there.
Wow.
Well, I'll just say, like, teams aren't moving good wings if they don't have to.
They may not have the same need for them as they did before. One team might need them more. They may offer more than 2 seconds. There's nuance here.
There is. But I'm just, but like, as a baseline view, like, yeah, man, we kind of need like 6, 7, 6, 8 dudes that can do stuff where that shoot, defend, some combination of the two, playmaker, yada, yada. If I am moving you for a second or 2 seconds, like once you get in the 3, 4, like the Sadiq Bey of like the Sadiq Bey trade was like a bunch of seconds, or one of the Sadiq Bey trades were a bunch of seconds, then like that obviously gets different, especially if you're talking about like high end seconds. But yeah, like you look at some of the guys that are moved, it's like, ah, I see it in hindsight. And so like point guard and big is kind of where I go if I'm going to move it. I'm just not moving. If I'm trading for a wing, I'm probably trading for one that's good enough to move a first four. And like, maybe that is a very, you are a man speaking into a microphone opinion versus someone in an actual NBA office or front office in general. But I think that's kind of where I go with that.
Got it. Well, speaking of moving, everyone out there, y'all don't move a muscle. We'll be back with more Dunker Spot after the break.
And we are back with this mailbag episode of the Dunker Spot. We got a couple of more questions before we get out of here. This one going to come from Ellie, who says, hello again to Kai and Steve. I'm writing today with a name that guy-esque question. I personally love reminiscing on random forgotten guy brand of sports stories, mostly because I find it really heartwarming that a guy who's worked his whole life to be for a professional sports career, but never got to be the main guy, still gets to be remembered for his impact. So I'm just wondering if you'd both share some of your favorite memories of lesser known players making the big play or having the big game, etc. One of my personal favorites was the all-bench Nets game in Indiana in 2022. I just remember Edmund Sumner going all the way off. He had a crazy dunk, which was really special to see because of his injury history and the fact he didn't really play much. Thanks and be easy.
I know you got a whole list, so I'll get out the way real quick.
I worked to limit the list today for that very reason. I love this question. It's always fun going back in the Wayback Machine.
Oh, I guess I won't go first.
Oh no, go ahead.
Joel Prisbilla getting a bunch of rebounds is very fun. Go on.
Oh, that was so yeah. Okay, well, we got the shortened one there. One to that Nets game, because I went back and watched the Edmund Sumner possessions from that game, which forgot how electric that first quarter was from him. Like, he finishes the game with 21-75. He had 14 in the first quarter. And it was just a mix of transition drives, the aforementioned dunk from Ellie. And, like, this random step back three in the midst of the run where you could tell he's just feeling it. And he's just happy to be back. And I was like, you know what? This is cool. Like, I remember also being sad about just the consistent injuries with Edna Sumner. So it was cool to kind of go back and see those shots. So that part was cool. That game ended up being 136 to 133 in regulation. Do you know what the net starting five for that game was, Steve?
No idea. Who was it?
Patty Mills, Edmund Sumner, Kessler Edwards, Markieff Morris, and Dayron Sharpe. It's a fun collection of five. It was Tyrese, Nembhard, Buddy Hield, Jalen Smith, and Miles Turner for Indiana. But anyway, fun game there. Wanted to limit my most recent one for me. Game one of the W Finals, Kia Stokes coming in cold for 13 and a half seconds and like blowing up the last possession for Phoenix with two switches. And in light of like she dug into like where she was mentally this season, like after the year and stuff like that, and like having that added context and made that stop even more special, in my opinion. So shout out to Kia Stokes for that one. Fun to go all the way back. Like, still wasn't a huge college guy, but it was cool watching the Kansas Memphis game way back when, and Mario Chalmers knocks down the big three there, eventually becomes a Miami Heat, and many a big playoff moments. But like, I don't think people remember 2013 finals, the game six. I think we all remember the Chris Bosh rebound to kick out the Ray Allen, etc. Miami ends up winning that game to win the game seven. People don't remember, like, LeBron was kind of insane in that fourth quarter and was very good in that game overall, leading up into that big play. Also, leading scorer for the Miami Heat after the first quarter, Mario Chalmers. Leading scorer for the Miami Heat in the at the end of the first half, Mario Chalmers. Finishes that game with 20 points. Solid game seven showing for him as well. Like, the back half of that finals, or the final three games of that final series, I don't think Tony Parker was that much better than him, if at all, for that three-game stretch. And, like, I feel like that just goes completely under the radar in history, but that's okay. That is just me being my thing. Last thing I mentioned, the Mike Miller shoeless three and just the three-point barrage for him in general in that OKC series in 2012 was fun. But, like, those are the three I limited to. I didn't want to go 15 minutes on that bit. But shout-out to Joel Prisbilla. And then the last question coming from Jordan, who says, hey guys, I'm curious about your experience with 2-3 zones at the youth, intramural, and rec levels. In my experience, a 2-3 zone tends to shut teams down until the offense, quote unquote, figures it out, and then the defense eventually has to switch back to man. Most people say the key is to get the ball into the middle of the zone, but when I play rec or pro-am on 2K, I've actually had more success going five out, pulling the big out of the paint, and forcing rotations until we get an open shooter. The downside, of course, is that if the team goes cold, or at the youth level, just can't shoot, that approach falls apart. For context, my intramural and men's leagues both. For context, my intramural and men's leagues teams both run a five-out system and pretty much live and die by the three. We shoot around 25% from deep in both leagues. Yes, we actually track our stats. So my question is, what do you think is the most efficient way to attack a rec level 2-3 zone?
I mean, the big key is just get it off balance. You can overload a side if you want to. Just make sure that your offensive people outmatch their defensive people, and eventually that will tilt for you. You can go five out if you want, because you can always flash into the middle if you'd like. But I mean, for me, it's always go with the pick and roll, get to one side, have someone loop to the other corner, and now let's play out of it. Because mathematically, eventually they're going to run out of people.
I like it. It's funny, like, the 2K example was brought up, because, like, when I play, it is generally, like, a five-out bit for us as well, and I'm always just like, ooh, we do have, like, good wings in particular that can score in the middle of the floor, like, get somebody to the free throw line, just let them bully people with post spins and stuff, like, we could do that too. We don't tap that button too much, but as far as my answer, like, I am generally a fan of get it to the middle, and let's get some cutting. And it's like, I would probably lean there, especially if your three-point shooting isn't up the stuff, and like if it's 25% across both of those teams, you probably want to try to get some interior based stuff. Like, to Steve's point, can we overload something? Can we create some 2v1s? Can we win from there? Like, something that I'm becoming more partial to, like watching NBA games at the very least, is, hey, like, how about we dribble the ball up, you know, middle of the floor or one side of the floor, and we're just gonna set a flare on the top of the zone and let's see what you do with it. Like, I was watching probably about a week and a half ago at this point, like, the Heat Raptors game. There was a possession where I think Toronto's on offense. It's like, okay, we screened the top of this. It's a 2v1. Norm Powell was kind of split in two between the guy at the wing going in the corner. He overplays it. It's just a wide open corner three. And it's like, you know what? That's, you should just do more of that. Like, I think that's fine, especially if we're talking about lower levels. I think that's an easy counter to just distort the zone, to Steve's point, overload it and create some openings from there. So that is where I would go. I don't know if five out is going to be the bit, unless you are really leaning into like some of the random cutting or you got some off-ball screens happening at like the edges of the zone and stuff like that. So that is where I would go. Steve, any closing thoughts on the zone bit before we get out of here?
No.
All righty. Fair enough. With that being said, then, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. And if you haven't subscribed yet, go ahead and subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel that is live. You can catch us and some familiar faces and voices on the channel. So come rock with us there. You can follow me on socials at NakaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.